Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. It is, once again, Mr. Gadgets coming to you over Hack Republic Radio, unless they should lose the ownership of the call-in line. Of course, I have to keep on calling in shows. It's like my duty, right? So, this one should come up fairly quickly after my last show that I have called in, the first show of this year, which was Get Off This Rock. Hopefully you enjoyed that one, and I do plan on talking about that kind of thing in the future. So today, I am going to talk a little bit about ham radio, amateur radio. I am an amateur radio operator and has been since the very early 90s, and I've had a long-term kind of love affair with radio, and I've always had this kind of desire to become an amateur radio operator, and finally saw that come to fruition there about 20 years ago. As I said, and I talked about in some previous episodes here, I got interested in electronics when I was a teenager, and primarily a lot of those first electronic kinds of things were about radio. It was building a crystal radio set. That was one of the first things that I learned how to build. And it was just a wonder to me. I know in today's modern world, with the modern conveniences and communications that we have, it seems to be a little bit old-fashioned, but it was just a wonder to me that I could take just a few components, two or three things, some wire that I literally wound in a coil on an oatmeal canister, a cardboard canister that oatmeal, at least in the U.S., would be delivered in. So it was a very pretty large diameter, 4 inches or so. Don't know what that is in millimeters exactly. And I could wind a coil there. Some of the wire would need to be bare. And a little crystal diode, or sometimes even a little piece of germanium and a cat's whisker, it was called. And I could position that there, get a little bit of rectification from the diode, and it could then have enough power just from the AM radio signals, long piece of wire, connect it to one end, and connect the right parts of the circuit. No batteries involved, no audio amplifiers or anything. A very sensitive set of, first I started with a crystal earphone, which was, actually the crystal earphone earpiece was a little bit bigger than today's ear pieces that, you know, ear headphones that you're used to using with a music player, but it would fit into your ear, and it was sensitive enough. There was enough electricity just to be over the air AM broadcast signals to have that then be rectified into the variations of the radio signal, which is how amplitude modulation works. It's varying the strength of the signal, and there was enough power to be generated in just that circuit with what it could receive over the air to move the little speaker in that crystal earphone set, and I could hear the AM radio station. Back in World War II, soldiers would actually make their own cat's whisker radio receivers with rusty razor blades. They could take a razor blade, the standard razor blade of the day, not the new modern ones with the multiple blades and stuff like that, but the old double-sided razor blade, they could take an old one that from their shaving kit, and the rusty parts of it would actually work kind of like the crystal for a crystal radio set, and they could come up with a cat's whisker. All they needed was a little bit of wire and a little earphone piece, and they could have a radio that they could listen to. And that just fascinated me. And then I started building other kits, as I kind of mentioned before. The ultimate kit, I think, that I built from the Radio Shack Corporation, which had various types of kits that they sold at the time. It came in a plastic box, and then the plastic box itself was the perforated board that you would use. The plastic top had a bunch of holes in it, and that's where you would build your circuit. And the most complex one of those was a shortwave radio receiver that I actually built from a kit. And there were lots of other kit kinds of things, heat kit being the most well-known of those. So a lot of things about radio. Radio in that time frame was the geek fashion. If you were a techie, if you were a geek, the way that you expressed your technical geekiness was radio. And this is long before computers actually existed in a form that any normal human being could actually, you know, afford one. So the radio fascinated me, as I said. I had an uncle who was into this, and he had no children, so he would tend to give presents out to the various, you know, cousins and things like that. And he bought me a radio that was Arvin, I believe it was, that had AM, FM, and a couple of shortwave bands, and I could listen to those. Back then, the amateur radio operators would also operate, you know, with amplitude modulation, at least some of them, so I could still listen to those. But along came another method of broadcasting the signal, which was called single sideband. AM radio, as I said, is a variation of the power, of the strength of the signal. And so if you looked at that on a device that would allow you to see the strength of the signal, you would see both sides growing and growing up and getting smaller, going up and getting smaller. It looked like waves, but it would be a mirrored wave, the top and the bottom. Well, single sideband only used one side of those. Unfortunately, without the right kind of extra equipment, my little shortwave receiver could no longer hear those properly. They sounded kind of like ducks quacking. It was anyway. So that kind of reduced my, you know, pleasure out of that radio, but I could still pick up shortwave radio stations from around the world. And at that point, it was very difficult to get a radio amateur license. You had to go to an actual FCC office. There was one in Kansas City, but it'd be in downtown Kansas City somewhere, to take the test for the more advanced things. If you happen to know someone who was already an amateur radio operator, they could give you what was the novice test. In the United States, there's a novice test, which has limited frequency kinds of privileges, various privileges up and down the radio spectrum. And then there was a technician class, which would give you a little bit extra frequencies you could operate on, general, and then I believe beyond that, at that time, there was an extra class license. Right now, there is a general, an advanced, and an extra class. So there are five classes of license in the United States. Another limiting factor back then was the equipment was all crystal controlled because of the variances that would occur with the analog equipment. You know, frequencies would vary off frequency, and so you would use a crystal to control the frequency of the operation, and novice transmitters would always have to be controlled by the frequency. Also, the major limiting factor back then was the Morse code requirement for any amateur radio license. So all the amateur radio licenses required that you pass a Morse code test. And trying to teach myself Morse code just never worked. I got books on it, and I attempted to memorize the dit nos and da dits and things like that, but it just never really worked for me. I did a CB radio or two during the CB radio craze in the middle 70s, and I went to my first ham fest in the middle 70s when the microcomputer revolution came along. It was not because I was an amateur radio operator and interested in the radios, but that was the source of a lot of chips and other kinds of components that would you would use in terms of building your own computer. And so I did attend the local largest amateur radio festival, ham fest. It used to be in downtown Kansas City at the old downtown airport. We built a new international airport up north of town. And there were still some terminal buildings back then, and they would rent those out to various groups. And there was a group in the spring that had a big ham fest. And I did attend that once or twice, looking for computer parts. And I believe I did pick up a few things there. Amateur swap meets are always an interesting thing because you'll see radios from back in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, even tube radios, because they're still very functional for amateur radio purposes. And in fact, there's a lot of people who really prefer those tube radios. I mentioned that a lot of amateur radio operators went off because it was more efficient for voice communication. They started using that single sideband, and there are in fact other kind of modes of communications with voice that have come along since then. A lot of them have gone back to the old AM radio signal, though, because it sounds so good. And so there are a few amateur radio operators that have acquired old AM radio transmitters from back in the 50s and early 60s, sometimes all the way back to the 40s. Some of them even acquire old AM radio transmitters that have been retired by radio stations and rework the frequencies of those, change the coils and such so that they would work on amateur radio frequencies and use those for AM radio transmissions to one another. The code requirement, as I said, always kept me from doing that and never did end up getting an amateur radio license when I was a youth. And then computers came along, and I started expressing my electronics interest in those, and that's the whole story that I've already told in multiple episodes. A very interesting author who still writes a blog that I read a lot of editorials and other kind of articles was an amateur radio operator, and he happened to mention in a column that he wrote that there was a lessening of the requirements for the technician class license and that it was no longer going to require Morse code. And so as soon as I heard that, his name is Jeff Dunkelman, a very interesting chap, was very instrumental in some of those early programming days and wrote a lot of articles on programming, which I would follow. Every time there was a Jeff Dunkelman article anywhere, even was editor of some magazines that I read on a regular basis, and it was in one of those editorials that he mentioned this. And so I jumped on it, got a book. I believe I might have even acquired that from Radio Shack, and studied up on the test for the technician class license. Found a local group. It had changed. You didn't have to go to an FCC office now to take a test. There were local amateur radio groups that would sponsor tests and submit those tests if you passed them. There were standardized tests that the FCC had, and there was even a way for you to study those tests. I found that the Gordon West book, who's still active in amateur radio to this day, the Gordon West book was the most interesting one for me because it had an easy way for you to go ahead and see the question and the answers to the questions in such a way that you weren't seeing the answers and giving it away to you, but it was fairly easy for you to follow along with the questions that were going to be, and there was a question pool, right, for the technician class license, and you could then take the test kind of for yourself, make sure that you had the answers. And there's various types of information that's included in these tests. There's information about the radio regulations, so that you understand the types of privileges that you have as a broadcaster of radio signals and how you're not supposed to interfere with television stations and radio stations and other uses of the radio frequencies, as well as power requirements and things, electronics theory, and good operating practice of your radio station so that you are working in harmony with other radio operators. And so there's various sections of the test, and I passed that and acquired my no-code tech license. It was called by everybody. That wasn't the official name of it, but there was a tendency, and it kind of reminds me of what's happening now in the computing world, especially in mobile devices, to a certain extent with Linux also, but especially with mobile devices. There's a certain amount of technical expertise that is involved with the radio craft and the Morse code. And don't get me wrong, I have the utmost of respect for Morse code operators. There are, unfortunately, they're passing away, quite a bit of them, but there are quite a few operators that were especially shipmen on Navy ships during World War II, where it was extensively used, but also, all of the military used Morse code for communications for their military operations as the most efficient way. And it is still the most efficient way. It's the simplest transmitter, simplest type of receiver, and it can get through the static and interference kinds of things more efficiently than any other mode of communication to this day. There are several, especially, as I say, old Navy chiefs from the war that can listen to Morse code at 50 words per minute and type it on a typewriter at 50 words per minute. They can actually probably do it at faster than that, and at 40 words per minute, they can actually listen to the Morse code, be typing it on the typewriter, and have a conversation with you in addition. The key to it is they didn't learn Morse code with the dits and dahs the way I tried to in my youth, teaching myself. They learned the sound of the letters. When you start sending Morse code at faster speeds, especially at the speeds of 40, 50 plus words per minute, at faster words per minute, like 20 words per minute, each letter doesn't become da-da-da-da anymore, or da-da-da, right, which happens to be a K, or da-da-da, right? The long symbols, you usually say da, the shorter symbols, you usually say dit. And da-da-da, right, is O. So dit-dit-dit, da-da-da, dit-dit-dit is S-O-S, right? But by the time you start sending it very fast, the entirety of the letter has a sound. And your real key is to learn the sound of the letter, the pattern of the dits and dahs, the way they sound all together at a faster pace, and that's the way to learn the Morse code. By the time you get up to 40 and 50 words per minute, the entire word has a sound to it, a pattern, which they start to recognize the entire word when it's sent at that speed. And it's really amazing. To this day, I'm not sure about the new keyboards that are a full QWERTY keyboard, right, a la BlackBerry or a slide-out keyboard or things like that. But the old P9 keyboards, right, you remember when you used to text and you had to press the A multiple times to get to A, B, C. And then you had to press the 2 multiple times, right, to get to C. Or to get to D, you had to press the 3 once, but to get to F, you had to press the 3 times, right? So the old T9 method of texting. And they would have contests between young people who were extremely fast at sending out these text messages, of course, because they do it constantly, and 60, 70-year-old men sending Morse code at 50 words per minute. And the old guys using Morse code always win. They can always send more information in a shorter period of time. This is kind of like talking about bandwidth. I happen to be driving on US 50 highway here in Missouri, and if I had, was driving in the other direction in a few hours, I'd be in St. Louis, Missouri. Okay, you want to know the fastest bandwidth to get several terabytes of data from Kansas City to St. Louis? Put it on hard drives. Assuming you have the hard drives that all the data is on, right? Okay, take the hard drives out of the machine, load them in the back of a van, drive to St. Louis. Right, that's the fastest bandwidth to get those terabytes of data to that other position to this day. So it all depends on your point of view, right? But you have to have very specialized skills in order to do this. Eventually, as an amateur radio operator, of course, once I got my technician license, I started going to ham fests. I used to get around with people. Some of the stuff that was older stuff that I saw and the computer parts that I saw when I went to ham fests in the middle 70s seemed to still be there, including all the old computer stuff. In the 90s when they started going to amateur radio ham fests. So there are several. We're lucky enough here in the Kansas City area to have several ham fests that are spread out throughout the year. And you go to those, you see people that you know, you kind of get to talk to them in real life instead of just on the radio and things like that. And amateur radio has always been important. It's got some reasons why it exists. For one thing, if there was a national emergency, the frequencies that are allocated to amateur radio operators would then be available to the military if they need extra frequencies, right? So it keeps any full-time commercial use to happen with those, and those frequencies would then be available for governmental use if they were necessary. We're also tasked with experimenting with these things technologically, and stretching the technologies that are involved with communications, as well as with emergency communications and providing those kinds of services. So those are some of the things that the amateur radio service is providing in exchange for all this valuable spectrum. And if you know anything about mobile radios and cellular telephone frequencies and things like that, radio spectrum is a very valuable thing, and millions of dollars are paid for the usage of radio spectrum. So why are we allowing these people for minimal costs of licenses to use that spectrum? Well, those are some of the reasons why. Now, lest you should think that getting on a radio and talking to somebody, which still I think is an amazing thing, I can throw a piece of wire up into a tree, okay, and I can then, using lower power radios that I have, but using the proper frequencies that have the ability to broadcast in the shortwave spectrum, which can go farther distances, I can talk to somebody with 5 watts of power, okay? Now, you know, I'm not sure exactly what the average cell phone nowadays has, but let's say that the average cell phone, to get to the cell tower that it has 1 watt of power. And so that would be 5 times the power that your cell phone has. But with a long wire that I throw up into a tree, I can talk to somebody from Missouri that's easily on either coast of the United States if the conditions are right. Now, if I have more power, of course, I can more reliably talk to people in other places. But if I'm on the right frequencies, I might be talking to somebody in Europe or down into South America. And there are other modes that are even more efficient with those low powers, and that's really what I'm kind of interested in, and some of the things that I still pursue. But lest you should think that this kind of technology is no longer affecting your life, okay? And eventually I did learn Morse code, once again, by learning the sounds of the letters, not the dit-dah patterns, but the actual sounds of the letters. I managed to pass the test for Morse code and got high-frequency kinds of privileges. Now, in the modern day, all of the frequency privileges, or most of the Western world at least, I think, the international standards have been revised, and it's no longer necessary for you to learn Morse code, even to use the longer distance frequencies, the shortwave radio frequencies, what's called high-frequency radio, HF radio. The types of frequencies that we use for mobile phones is related to walkie-talkies, or what the amateur radio operator would call handy-talkies now. And those are very high frequencies, VHF. To give you an idea, just above the AM radio band is really the start of some of the lower frequencies that amateur radio operators are allowed to use. But the ones that they use mostly are have wavelengths, and they always talk about these wavelengths in the length of the radio wave to make a complete cycle, how long it would move at the speed of light. So that's directly related to how long your antenna needs to be. And so there's 160 meters. So it's 160 meters for an entire, starts at zero, goes to its highest point, goes back to zero, goes to its lowest point, and goes back to zero again. That's a complete cycle. 160 meters at the speed of light. So you would need a antenna that was at least 80 meters long in order to broadcast effectively on that. There are ways to get around it, but the laws of physics are bendable but not breakable. So yes, you can less efficiently, and you'd have to pump more power into it, use an antenna that was less long than that. So these are very long pieces of wire that you need. But with the right length of wire and a very long piece of wire at the right height above the ground, you can use less and less power to talk very, very long distances. VHF is starting to get into some of the areas that you're more familiar with, VHF, the amateur frequencies for VHF are in the 144 megahertz range, 144 cycles per second. That's a much shorter, that's the 2 meter band, so it only takes a 2 foot length of wire, right? And you feed that from the middle in order to make a standard antenna for that. And we also have 440, which is the 70 centimeter band. So we're getting higher and higher in frequency, shorter and shorter in terms of antenna length that would be necessary. To give you an idea, the 800 megahertz band is what initially some of the cordless phones were in. Some cordless phones are in the 2.4 gigahertz range. And when we're talking about the kinds of equipment that you have for Wi-Fi wireless and things like that, the 2.4 and the 5 gigahertz range, those are very close to some amateur radio bands that are also in effect. But we have lower frequency bands, which are more efficient. But anything that is in those very high frequency and above ranges are very short ranges for the duration. It's very similar to FM radio. FM radio in the United States, and I think internationally also, it's very close to this. The spacing apart of channels, maybe for the different regions of the world, but the frequencies are very similar. FM radio goes from about 85 megahertz to 108 megahertz. Okay? So that's just a little bit below the VHF kind of range that we're talking about for amateur radio operators. And in that particular case, and I don't know if you've noticed this about your FM radio station, you can't hear your FM radio station very far out of the city that it resides, right? You can only hear that because it's a line of sight communication. If you remember Independence Day, right? They're explaining line of sight communications, and the president understands those because he was an aircraft pilot, supposedly, before he became president, and so he understood line of sight. So line of sight means that the frequencies essentially travel like light at that particular point. There's nothing that's able to bend to them, and therefore they just keep on going straight in whatever direction they were going when they first came from the transmitter. And so because of the curvature of the Earth, they will go straight out into space, and you will only be able to see and hear those, and thusly hear those radio frequencies as if you could see the transmitter. Now, it's too far away for you to see the lights on the transmitter, but the radio frequencies will travel straight, and once you go beyond the horizon, because of the curvature of the Earth, you would no longer be able to hear that radio station. That's not the way AM radio works, especially at night. There are certain AM radio stations. Have you ever noticed your local AM radio station probably reduces its power at night? So a radio station you can hear perfectly well during the day, once sunset comes, it reduces its power. But there are certain radio stations that boost their power, and you can hear radio stations from a long way away at night. One reason they do this is because the propagation of the radio waves down in that spectrum that is used by AM radio, right, which is in the kilohertz range, not the megahertz range, that's a much longer traveling signal. And at night, the conditions for that to travel farther, there's various reasons why. It bounces off the ionosphere of the planet and bounces back down again, so it doesn't just go off into space and keep on going. There's various reasons why it bounces down again. Likewise, there are other kinds of atmospheric conditions and things like that that can cause the radio waves to actually go up, bounce off conditions that are in the atmosphere, and come back down to Earth again. And sometimes they make multiple hops. That's the reason why I can use very little power and talk to somebody who's hundreds or even thousands of miles away with my piece of wire up in the tree when I'm using those lower frequency, the HF bands. That's why the AM radio station in the United States here, there's always a high power station out of St. Louis, Missouri that you can listen to at night, another one out of New Orleans or somewhere down there in Louisiana, out of Chicago. There's a few particular stations across the AM radio dial that would boost their signals at night, and then you could listen to them, but you'd only be able to hear them at night. You wouldn't be able to hear them during the day. And the conditions at night are even more so to towards getting that long distance kind of communication. And this kind of communication is still benefiting you right to this day. The amateur radio operators are the ones who came up with a way to go beyond this line of sight problem with VHF. Back in the early 70s, somebody came up with the idea of, hey, what if we put a receiving station way high up on a tower, either on a mountain, if we have to have mountains, or up on the tallest building that will let us do it, and we'll have a little receiving station that will receive at such and such a megahertz, and then we'll rebroadcast it on another transmitter that has another antenna, and it'll be just far enough away in megahertz that it won't interfere, so we'll be able to use a little small individual, like walkie-talkie kind of radio, and as long as it's got enough power to be heard by that first antenna up on top of the building or up on top of the tower or the mountainside, and then it'll rebroadcast with a stronger signal out, and since it's so high, we'll get better line of sight, and so now I'll be able to talk even farther because I'm effectively changing the rules about line of sight by putting the receiving antenna and the transmitting antenna way up high. And so they started experimenting with this and figured out how to make it better and better and better. And eventually, there is a network of repeater towers across the entire U.S. And in fact, in every major area of the world, there are repeating towers. They're used for radio communications for commercial purposes. This is the basis for all of the radio communications that are used by police and fire. And essentially, this is the very start, the little baby steps towards the cell phones that you have in your pocket or strapped to your belt right now. So essentially, amateur radio operators, you talk about, there's a lot of this whole talk in the technical world about patents and invalidating patents because who did it first and who copied who and things like that. So I'm not going to get into that right now. I may do that on a future show, but I'll tell you one thing. You wouldn't have a cell phone, you know, in the size that it is in your hand, and you might even be listening to this very podcast on some kind of mobile device. And that would not exist without the amateur radio operators who developed the first technologies and proved that those technologies would work. And then they were commercialized, and they have revolutionized radio communication around the world. In fact, I often joke, you know, back in high school, if I had a handy-talkie on my belt, I would be the biggest nerd around. But the one real clue to me that the nerds have won, right, is not just that it's the technical people that are the richest people in the world now, not the football players who don't play professional football, who don't happen to go on to professional sports and things like that. It's not the high school quarterback, right, who goes on, unless he's a salesman for a technical company. It's the Bill Gates of the world, right? It's the Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs of the world. It's the geeks, right, that have taken over the world. Revenge of the nerds, if you will. And the true revenge of the nerds in my mind is everybody essentially walks around with a handy copy on their belt, assuming they've still got a belt clip. And some of them even have push-to-talk buttons, right? Remember the whole push-to-talk in cell phones? It's essentially just using those. Now, they're digital communications instead of just simple FM communications, like cell phones initially were. But it was all based on that kind of technology. So the kind of things that amateur radio operators are doing still to this day are spreading communications kinds of things, expanding those kinds of things. Another thing that's happening in the amateur radio community right as I'm speaking right now is the weather conditions here. If you're outside the U.S., you're probably less aware of this, although it might have made some international broadcasts also. Last year, at least here in the middle of the country, we had too much water. We had a lot of rain, and in addition to that, we had a lot of snowfall over the winter, and that then melted off and came down through the rivers, and we had flooding. It's a terrible time with flooding of the Missouri River system and the upper Mississippi river system here in the United States, which is a big part of the farming community, are all tied to that. And a lot of those fields did not produce the grains that they normally would because of the flooding conditions. And there were major highways that were closed, et cetera, et cetera. We have the exact opposite of that this year. We have drought conditions. They've had some drought conditions down in Texas that have been going on for multiple years, but now the entirety of the Great Plains is in drought conditions, as well as up in the mountains, because we did not have as much snow. And there's a peculiar kind of thing that's always problematical. And in fact, in Missoula, Montana, where my youngest daughter has pursued a master's degree up there at the University of Montana there in Missoula, go Grizzlies, right near her house, right next to the airport that I float in and out of to visit them and do some business trips and things like that, is the station where all of the people who are fire jumpers actually train, and they fly out of that to actually parachute out of airplanes. Talk about, you know, it's one thing to parachute out of a perfectly good airplane. It's quite another thing to parachute out of a perfectly good airplane when you know there's a fire down there and you're going to be fighting it. And basically, they fight those fires by containing them and clearing out brush and making sure that the fire cannot jump from one tree to the next by moving dirt and clearing out brush, et cetera, et cetera. And there are several fires that have started. This is a totally natural phenomenon. In fact, there are trees that actually exist that will not, their seeds will not germinate unless a fire occurs. The actual seed pod will not break open, right, unless there's a fire, and that's what causes the seed pod to break open, and thusly, there's a possibility of growing a new tree. So it's not like fires like this aren't natural occurrences, and they are not, by and large, caused by man. They are, by and large, caused by lightning strikes. And there's a severe problem with some fires that are moving out of control in Colorado, in the Rocky Mountains there, in the Denver area, Boulder, and things like that, and even north of that, I believe, up into Fort Collins, and down in Colorado Springs area, and then all the way down to Flagstaff in northern Arizona. And there's several fires at various points there. There are amateur radio operators that are there working in conjunction with the firefighters, maybe not right on the front line with those guys that parachute out of the trees, but at the forward command post. And they're there with amateur radio positioning systems, a precursor to GPS, right? GPS-based, the GPS systems that you have in your car, amateur radio operators started doing that with amateur frequencies. They not only take the GPS signal, but they also broadcast back their positions with amateur radio repeaters or high-frequency kinds of frequencies with digital modes, and they can be there with equipment that will then give exact position of where the fire is being fought at any given time, and those positions can be fed back to the control areas for the firefight, so that they have a more accurate picture of exactly what the size, shape, and physical, severity of the fire is. In fact, I just heard a story about amateur radio operators that were called in for a fire that was in Boulder. The amateur radio operators came to the fire and not only set up these APRS and other kinds of digital communications into the system. They also set up amateur television, right, which would use some of those higher frequencies like 440 megahertz, 900 megahertz, and above to broadcast television pictures of the fire so they could get a live feed in the master control that was in charge of that emergency situation. And they could have big screen live views of what was happening with the fire. The federal government came in, because this was still at the state and county level, and if the fire stays below a certain size, it will not then fall under the purview of the National Forest Service, I suppose, or other kinds of emergency things that happen at the federal level. They came in when that was still at an E2 size. The severity of the fire was not sufficient to warrant them being involved, but they wanted to check the situation out. They came into the control center, saw the live big screen TV feeds of the fire, went out and visited the sites where the amateur television stations were broadcasting this live feed back to the control, and were not aware that this kind of technology was even available, that amateur radio operators could provide this type of service, and requested specifically if this got to an E1 status, and thank the higher power, right? Thank God, or whatever else you want, the universe, the universal consciousness, whatever. It did not. It stayed at a smaller scale and is not going to be spreading to actually have an even wider situation where they have to fight this fire. But if it had gotten to that E1 classification and had spread, they specifically requested that the amateur radio operators remain available and provide them feeds for larger fires. And I imagine that other fires now are going to start having these live feeds, and other emergencies are going to start having these live feeds. When things like tornadoes happen, floods happen, other things like that, amateur radio operators go into those areas and set up temporary cell towers so that things can provide communications for that, temporary communications, and can provide information in and out of those disaster areas until such time as infrastructure can be restored and normal communications can then resume. So if there is a flood, if there is a fire, if there's an emergency, Italy, when they had that recent set of earthquakes there in northern Italy, outside of Milan by several hundred kilometers, they're in Tuscany, I believe, but I may not be in the right area, but somewhere there in northern Italy, and it was a relatively rural area. There was not a lot of communications in the first place, and the occurrence of that earthquake had completely knocked out all communications to the area. Amateur radio operators from various places there in northern Italy were requested to go in. They went in and set up equipment so that emergency communications and health and welfare, right, is my family okay, that kind of thing, digital as well as voice communications could be established to get to the nearest city of any size that still had communications, which was, I think, something like 80 kilometers away, if I'm remembering correctly. So amateur radio operators provide that kind of disaster communications, and they volunteer to do this. Whatever county you live in, and especially if you're in any major area, there's probably an emergency communications group of amateur radio operators who are ready, willing, and able to provide these kinds of communications to your community if a disaster takes place. Now, some things that you might be of interest. That same radio that I talked about that I could actually used to talk to someone with only 5 watts of power. Some of the things I used to do with that radio when I was doing this, and I'm getting ready to get more radioactive like this again, is I could use a digital form that all I needed was a computer and some software, and this is available in all the different operating systems. You can even do this with tablet PCs and things like that, be it iOS-based, you know, an iPad or an Android version of that. There are digital modes that essentially use the sound card of your PC and the display of your PC, your laptop or your tablet, and you have a special cable that plugs into the radio, and you go onto these HF bands. So we're talking about longer range communications here, but tiny amounts of power, right? Very small amounts of power, but a big long piece of wire up high in the tree. And I would sit on my deck at night, throw a piece of wire up into the tree, and hook it up to my radio, hook my laptop up to that, and you'll literally see the frequencies. You can hear them over the speaker of the PC. You can hear these little warbling tones. Kind of reminds me of the old days with modems, if you remember what the modem sounded like, only it's a little bit more musical and a little bit less jarring than the old modem tones. But you can hear these tones of signals over the radio, and you can literally see them. There'll be multiple signals that are little lines that are going up the screen. It's kind of like the Matrix, only in reverse. They go from the bottom of the screen to the top. And you move this little pointer over to one of those strong signals, and all of a sudden, a little space there that's available on the user interface on your PC then starts showing you the text that the person on the other end of the conversation is typing in on their computer with similar types of equipment. And I sat in my backyard or down at a vacation cabin that belongs to my father on a pleasant summer evening with nothing but a piece of wire thrown into the air and a minuscule amount of power and my laptop, and type messages back and forth to people down in the South America, across the entire United States and Canada, once or twice, even all the way over into Europe. Over the air. We talk about Ethernet now. You know, in the early days of radio, one theory about how radio worked was there was this thing they proposed that was the ether. There was some kind of magical substance that was the reason why that these things transferred from place to place. Ethernet kind of gets its name from that old hypothesized mythical ether, right? That was the way that these things. But if you're really communicating across the ether, you're communicating wirelessly to somebody in another state, in another country, on another continent. If you don't think that's cool, you don't have to do it. You'll benefit from the various ways that we will improve that as amateur radio operators and improve communications. Last bit before I part with you here on this particular episode is there are organizations for each country that license the amateur radio operator. There are probably different classifications of licenses for your particular country. I do happen to know that it's the Radio Society of Great Britain that is the people who handle that kind of thing and would be the people you can get in contact with about getting a license if you're in the UK. Here in the U.S., that's the primary group that regulates it, of course, is the Federal Communications Commission. The Radio Society of Great Britain is not the regulatory group, but they're the primary group of amateur radio operators, the organization that represents them. And they could tell you information about, probably have study materials, right, for the test that would be appropriate there for the U.K. Whatever country you're in, there would be an appropriate group probably that would provide you those kinds of things. In America, that's called the American Radio Relay League. That actually, that relay in that happens to refer to the old days when there was very low power involved, and amateur radio operators would actually receive a message from one person and then relay it on to the next person. So they would actually pass messages along and relay those. That's where the Relay League actually comes from. This is from the very, very early, very, very low power days of amateur radio operations. And there's W5YI provides some testing. If you have a Radio Shack store near you, I would highly recommend some of the study materials that are there. Make sure in the U.S., I'm sure it's the same for all of the countries involved, but I happen to know more about the U.S., there's always a set of question tools, and eventually they change those questions. They refine the test and change some of the questions. So make sure you're getting a book that is the current book for whatever license class. You probably want to start out with a technician's class license and then move on from there. There's probably a group not too far away from you that could offer to do the testing for you. They usually do testing like this at the HamFest, so there's probably a HamFest that wouldn't be too far of a drive away from you. I happened to drive to a HamFest that was not too far, about 40 miles from my house in a little town called Warrensburg, Missouri. It's a small regional HamFest that's close enough to the Kansas City area that a lot of people from Kansas City come out there. I might comment sometime in the future about amateur radio and and what it was like to go to that. But that was what reminded me about amateur radio. It's something that I'm kind of rekindling my interest in, and dusting off some radios, acquiring a little bit of new equipment, and going to get more radioactive right now. Right now is a good time to be an amateur radio operator because the sunspot cycle is up. And when the sunspot cycle is up, it helps in some of those propagation of those radio waves to be able to talk around the world for longer distances with higher frequencies. And, of course, the higher the frequency, the easier it is to build an antenna because it's shorter. And so that makes it for a more beneficial situation if you have limitations in what the size of your antennas can be. That's a cycle that's like an 11-year cycle. So eventually we'll get into a trough, and then 11 years from now we'll be up to, close to the top of the cycle again. So we happen to be close to the top of the cycle now, and it's kind of in 11-year cycles that the sunspots work. So I look forward to any comments about this. Are there any other amateur radio operators out there amongst the Hacker Public Radio crowd? If you're interested in some of these digital modes and things like that, be sure to leave some comments. You can always leave comments to me, right, at Hacker Public Radio or HPR, either one, at Mr. Gadgets, that's MRGADGETS.com. And I welcome any kind of comments about any of the episodes that I leave here. Or you could go over even and go to MrGadgets.com. And that's basically just my Blogspot blog. But you could Twitter me. I'm Mr. Gadgets, right, on Twitter. I'm also Mr. Gadgets, I believe. We get to me on Google Plus. Or I am Bruce Barr, right? And so you can get to me there on Google Plus. Leave some comments to me, either on the comments on the HBR blog or on, for this episode, or get in touch with me some of those other ways. Let me know what you think. If you're interested in amateur radio kinds of things, radio transmitters, things like that, we could certainly talk about those some more. But it's certainly an interesting, geeky hobby, and it kind of meshes with the communications capabilities. This is a way for you to be able to communicate even when Twitter is down and your high-speed internet is down. You can still communicate with people, and if an emergency takes place, you probably aren't going to have high-speed internet, and your cell tower is probably not going to work either. But there are modes that you can actually use to communicate, and you can serve your community in helping out if, Lord forbid, a disaster should take place. So for now, the way we would say this in amateur radio parlance, I'll say 73, which in Morse code is a mirror image of one another, the dit and dah pattern for the 7 and the dit and dah pattern for the 3 are an exact mirror image, right? The dits are dahs and the dahs are dits. And so that is how you would sign off as a CW transmission. You would say 73, DE, which means from AB0YO, which is my amateur radio call sign. And we often use, it's hard sometimes to hear what the letters are, so we use words, which the first letter of the word, right, represents the letter. So that would be Alpha Bravo Zero Yankee Oscar. This goes all the way back to military. And the military guys would have a coding system that would indicate what the letters of the alphabet are, and they would spell them out by using the words. So, 783, DEAB0YO, and we hope to talk to you in the not-too-distant future, and maybe even on the air. And until then, be careful out here on the technological frontier. Whether it's using radio waves or Ethernet cables or cell phones, always remember, you're talking to somebody else. It just happens to be they're not in the room with you. Bye now.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HBR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HBR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.